Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.ByteRadio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today is a Children's Corner show with my very special guest being Dr. Don McManus, and we're going to be talking about the strong-willed child. Dr. Mack is a psychologist and has had the privilege of helping thousands of kids and families over the past 45 years. One of his main passions is to transform the latest findings from family studies and brain research into fun, powerful, and effective tools for change, helping parents create healthy families. Nothing in the world warms Dr. Mack's heart like the smiling, happy faces of the folks he has helped, or the precious times with kids that gives him the benefit of a bird's-eye view into their little hearts and minds. Co-author of two highly acclaimed parenting books, Dr. Mack is also involved in a number of creative projects for children. In addition to writing songs for television, Dr. Mack has written a play and has produced an award-winning series of more than 50 songs and activities that help boost character, social, and emotional skills. Throughout Dr. Mack's endeavors, he treasures the value of humor in bringing about change. For more information, you can visit his website, which is strong-willedchild.com. Again, that's strong-willedchild.com. And I do have a direct link to his website in the show page description. So with that, I'd like to welcome Dr. Mack to the show. Good day, sir.
Thank you so much.
I'm really happy to have you here. I've known a strong-willed child or two in my day. And,
You've seen them, huh?
That wasn't me, but there's a definite challenge with working with children like that. So I guess the best place to start, and if you wouldn't mind sharing a little bit about who you are and your background, just so that the listeners get an idea of where you're coming from.
Yeah, well, great. Well, you've covered it pretty well. I am a director of a nonprofit here in Santa Barbara, and so we have 14 therapists, and I've been spending years now teaching psychology, specializing in work with kids. You know, I went to Dartmouth, and then I was in Boston and University of Virginia for a degree in school child psych, so I'm one of the few old-timers that's, like, totally into kids, specializing in work with kids in the 2 to 12 age range. And then on my side, I wear another hat, which is as a songwriter and song producer, and I had a show years ago called J.J. the Jet Plane on PBS, and my current show is called Mutton Stuff, which is the number one show on Nick Jr. So I've got a lot of fingers and a lot of pies, but I really have a very diverse life, and I love what I do, and I love helping families and helping kids. So largely the work that I do is not directly with kids so much, although that happens. It's to a greater degree helping parents to bring out the best that they can bring out in their children.
Yeah. Well, that's important. And it's wonderful that you have that creative outlet, that creative side too, because it's important and for balance, and I think that too also I would think would give you just a whole lot of insight, you know, into children, just beyond the the structured environment of working with parents and counseling and that kind of thing.
Right. Well, music is such a powerful tool for helping children too, and there's actually ways that I've integrated many of the songs into my work. As an example, there's a lot of kids now. We're not even talking about the strong-willed kid at this point, but the most increasing population of kids needing help are kids who have anxiety problems. So I've even integrated some of the songs into, here's a song, you know, take two songs and call me in the morning kind of thing, you know. Songs that have a teaching element to them, even though primary number one thing is entertainment. If it's not entertaining, they're not going to listen, they're not going to pay attention.
Yeah. Well, as a matter of fact, I saw on the news last night that there was a YouTube video that went viral of a young Down syndrome boy and his sister, and sister was playing music and playing a song, and it was of the boy learning his first words and through the music,
okay.
And then the parents were told that he wouldn't speak for a long, long time, and yet here he is, you know, responding to the song.
Exactly. Well, it's, you know, the music lights up different areas of the brain than language, so there's also examples of people with strokes who can't talk and ask for what they want, but they can sing it. They can sing what they, you know, will you get me a piece of toast? You know, they can put a little jingle to it, and they can express themselves. So both for kids on the spectrum and for people who've had some kind of head injuries, it's so clear how music lights up so many different centers of the brain that it's so beneficial for learning, too, so.
Yeah. So, and for those of us who don't necessarily have those limitations, it's, you know, it can have the same effect as far as helping us. So, for everybody to sing a little bit. So, you have a particular program that you have developed. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'd love to. You know, it took years for me to figure out that there's lots of different solutions for how to parent strong-willed kids, and it's pretty integrative. It includes anything from sleep and exercise to having a positive ratio of, you know, 5-to-1 ratio is what we call it, of positive interactions with the child, and there's a whole set of things that we've learned from the brain research about how it is that we don't want to deal with kids who are strong-willed, but you know, it's almost an epidemic, Robert. Of it's still happening that parents or people see, you know, kids in restaurants and they seem to be running around and their parents aren't in control and that kind of stuff. And what happens when kids have too much power in the family is that they're really at risk for a whole bunch of problems. You know, problems with peers, problems with paying attention, you know, problems in school, getting in trouble, and it's really important for parents to give their kids lots of love and warmth, for sure, but on the other hand, what makes kids thrive is firmness and structure. So, you know, I'll give you a fun little example. There's this little girl comes into a first session, and I hadn't asked this question before, but I turned to her in her first session with mom, dad, and this young 4-year-old who had been kicked out of her third preschool for biting.
Oh, okay.
So I say to little Sarah, Sarah, you know, who's the boss in your family? And she says, she points to her father, and her father starts to giggle, and then the mother bursts into laughter, and I said, so what's so funny? And the mom says, yeah, that's so not true. And then Sarah turns to me and she says, yeah, mommy's right. I'm the boss in the family, but mommy wants to be the boss. That's why we're here. So here's
that's
the kid not only had her parents wrapped around her little finger, but she was very aware of it and using it to great advantage to her and humor. But there's a tremendous disadvantage of kids having so much power because they don't know how to respond to teachers in school. And
right.
You know, so what I did was I developed a program that is what I call win-win, meaning that when kids have so much authority or power, as I said, they ideally they don't change like overnight. And so there's a program that I actually builds in a few different elements to it over the course of a few weeks where the child is involved in some new decisions and some new rule setting and that kind of thing. But, you know, we've got kids who won't go to bed when their parents ask them to. There's kids who, you know, obviously getting in trouble in school, throwing temper tantrums. I had a mom just the other day who, you know, I can't go out to a restaurant that I want. Well, why not? Because my 8-year-old tells me, you know, they're not going to go if you know. So it's kind of, whoa, you know, how aggravating can that be to a parent when their child is telling them what to do instead of vice versa? And obviously, you know, what we want is respect to flow in both directions, and that's what allows kids to be happy. So the misconception is sometimes if you set limits with kids, well, then they're going to be, you're going to lower their self-esteem or whatever. And the bottom line is when limits are set in a caring and loving way, then they thrive. They, you know, they become more inspired, to tie into your radio idea. You know, the inspiration comes from when people don't feel anxious, don't feel guilty. So kids, when they have so much power, they don't feel good about themselves, and they're thwarted in their attempts to learn and to be connected to other people and to kind of put themselves in an appropriate place in the world, which is, you know, you are not the center of the universe. Sorry to break that news to you. So,
yeah
that's
Is that kind of, you know, I mean, we really have, you know, I mean, it seems many kids nowadays, or parents, really do place their kids in that setting, in like, the sense of being, you know,
like on a pedestal.
Yeah, on a pedestal. So is that where it kind of starts, as far as creating that willful spirit?
It can. I've had lots of cases, and, you know, living here in Santa Barbara, I see everything from people who are sort of on the lower end of the spectrum economically all the way to, you know, rock stars and bank presidents, and it cuts across. I mean, sometimes kids have had their mom at their beck and call for their first 4 or 5 years, and the mom will let the child win the game all the time, or, you know, that undivided attention. So they haven't learned, especially if they don't have another sibling, how to share attention and how to not be the center of attention. So I have in first session sometimes a nanny and the two parents, because the nanny has to be able to set limits too. And so kids who have they can be in preschools too, and or have a child care person like a grandmother who's watching over them, who doesn't want to disturb little Johnny and make things tough for him, and so they just let them get away with things. So yeah, it can happen very early on. There's a whole bunch of other, I mean, you know, some kids are just born way more stubborn, you know, and that strong-willed thing is kind of a temperamental characteristic. But then you add on top of that, here's how the kid is sort of pre-programmed, and then add on top of that ways that, for example, a parent might not want to set a limit with kids, with their child, because, you know, they've just been through a divorce, or there was a fire in Santa Barbara, and it's like, oh my gosh, my poor child has suffered so much, so I'll just let off the stops, and that's an okay thing for a little while, but bottom line is you have to sort of reinstitute, you know, appropriate, age-appropriate rules and consequences, and like I say, always lots of love. Some kids are pretty feisty or have behavior problems in part because their parents are in conflict. So, you know, the parents want to drop the child off and say, will you fix him and fix her or whatever? And, you know, it's kind of like, I'm sorry, you know, I'm a family therapist. I really, really see the importance of context about the sort of the water that the fish is swimming in. You know, you want to change the water. So some parents will say, you know, we realize that our kid is acting out because we're having some struggles ourselves, and he's picking up the tension, and he hears us fighting behind, even if it's behind closed doors, and in a very responsible way, they'll say, you know, we need to attend to our couple's stuff first. And that's not an infrequent thing. I have a whole section in my program that focuses on, what do you do if you're not on the same page with your partner? Because you can be fighting about sex or credit card debt or an affair that happened 5 years ago or whatever it is, and you sort of have to get your act together as parents before you take it on the road and try and implement some new way of being with a child. So that's another biggie.
Yeah. So you know, as far as you know the just the environment, you know, I mean, when it comes to you know having a child who misbehaves, you know, there, like you say, there's so many factors, and it probably happened over quite a period of time. So that you'd have to, you know, expect that it's going to take a period of time to reverse those effects or the environment, you know, in order to kind of create different types of behaviors.
Yeah. With the program that I use, though, and this is with over 1,000 families, it's typically around significant change within the week, but definitely 80-90% improvement within a month. So it's not that long, because what's interesting, unlike parents who can get sort of more stuck in their personality and way of being, it's so fascinating how children can turn around given how you might change what's going on in their life. So here's another really interesting thing. I mean, I have tons of families where, well, how is your child in school? And some kids have problems in school and at home, and that sort of makes sense. Well, this is internal to the kid, and he's acting the same way, right? But there's tons of kids who are doing just fine in school, or they do just fine with grandmother or even the lady next door. And, okay, so the plumbing's all there, so what's the deal here? What's different about it? And I'll actually say that to kids, too. I say, why, you know, I hear that you're a perfect angel. Your teacher talked to me and said you're just totally cool there, and you're really popular, and you're doing great academically, and yet he's got his parents wrapped around his finger. So obviously, with a child like that, there can be very rapid turnaround because they're all wired up to be able to act appropriately. They just need to have the right consequences. And you know, anybody and everybody sort of lets their guard down a little bit and becomes a little looser when they're in their home environment. You know, obviously,
yeah.
You know, with couples, that's an issue too. It's like, you know, you let your hair down and you become more real when you're with your partner and you're not as guarded or edited. So anyway, it's an interesting thing. But, you know, a lot of kids, what happens is this loop gets started where the child's acting out and then the parent gets mad, or they repeat themselves, or they, you know, they're raising the voice, repeating and lecturing. All are very problematic because then there's this loop, which I can talk to in a minute if you wanted to, about mirror neurons and all this brain research that we now know has really important implications for how to parent in general, not alone strong-willed kids, and also for couples' relationships. So that's been one of my favorite things, is to stay on top of what's going on. There's all this great new information out there that has applications to relationships.
Yeah. So, I do want to get to that, you know, the mirror neurons and that kind of thing, because I'm always fascinated with science, too, and how that affects behavior. Before we get there, I want to, you talked about a couple times of, you know, of setting limits and consequences. When it comes to consequences, now there is a big, you know, back and forth about spanking. I mean, I my personal feeling is that you're teaching violence. you don't like what you're doing, they're gonna smack you, and you know, if you don't like what somebody else does, you're gonna smack them. You know, But what's your opinion on that? How
what's my take on that? Well, I stand with by far the largest majority of professionals in the health field, you know, and parenting experts to say that there really is, out of the thousands of kids I treated, there has never been a child that would have responded well to spanking. And there's a few reasons for that, Robert. I mean, you know, probably the one of the most important is what you already mentioned, which is that any form of physical force that you're using with a child is a model for aggression. And so there's research that shows that kids who have been spanked are more likely to act out in ways that are aggressive with others, in part because, you know, it's an assault. A child is, they identify so much with their bodies, and so what we want to do for effective parenting is say, you know, Nathan, I don't like that behavior. That's not okay. And use, you know, mildly aversive consequences. But when you're spanking, you are sort of, you're injuring the child and you're injuring their body. And it's sort of, it's more internalized by the kid as there's something bad about them rather than their behavior. So always differentiating between, you know, we love you dearly, you're a wonderful kid, you know, we're so glad you're in our life and yada, yada. And this behavior is not okay, and here's the consequence. And to be able to do that in a matter-of-fact way rather than to raise the intensity of your voice. So it damages their self-esteem. They think they're bad, that kind of thing. And the interesting but unfortunate statistic is that probably, I think the latest is that more than three-quarters of parents still spank their kids. I sometimes have to assure parents that if they have spanked their kid, oh my gosh, you know, it doesn't mean they're going to be in therapy for the rest of their life like Woody Allen or something.
Right.
You know,
right.
But more to the tune of things, like if you are spanking your kids as a regular pattern, if that's your go-to tool for handling their discipline, well, then that's going to be problematic for sure. And I've never seen an exception to that. So don't freak out if you've ever spanked your kid and it's like, well, no, but just learn some better ways, because you certainly don't want to do that. But it's understandable, too, because, you know, when a kid's in your face and you have this feeling inside as a parent of, wow, you know, I bust my butt to be kind to you. I work hard. I give you, you know, your meals and your toys and your electronic games, and I give you all these things, and you're going to be disrespectful to me. Well, that really pisses parents off. And, you know, we want to get into probably at some point in our discussion here, well, what do parents do about that? Because that's the thing. It's the big feelings that drive a cycle where the parent gets upset, then the child gets upset, then the parent's like, and then it's a cycle and it's a loop and it can go on forever. And it's sometimes it goes underground, and those are the kids that are more likely to act out with the peers or to torture their dogs or cats or their little brother, that kind of thing. Nick's on the spanking thing, it mostly for the reason that there's better ways, you know. It's just kind of like with every form of consequence that we use, you want to think about it like medicine, you know, like if I had a really bad headache and one aspirin isn't enough, then I want to take a few more, but I don't want to take the whole bottle, because the side effects of too much consequences with kids are just as bad as for too few. And so we're back to that psychological precept that's just threaded throughout all of research in psychology, is that if in doubt, moderation is what works best. You know, with tons and tons of things, moderation is the key to success in relationships.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Dr. Mack, we're about halfway through, so I want to take just a quick break. I do want to invite listeners, if they would like to call in and ask you any questions, they can call 619-789-4359. And for those listening live in the chat room, if you have any questions, feel free to type them in. And then when we come back, you know, we talked about consequences. So, I mean, and you know, like the medicine, different consequences for different types of things. So can you, when I come back, maybe we can talk a little bit about different types of consequences, you know, that would be appropriate to certain types of behaviors. Okay?
Sure. We'd love to.
Okay,
yeah.
Great. Everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back after this brief break.
Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, www.biteradio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link that will give you access to more than 1,200 shows we have had over the past 7 years. Also on the site are links to the products and services we provide, books, greeting cards, photography, and a wellness store. Our show is available as a free podcast on iTunes, and you can subscribe for free at the iTunes Store, or even quicker, there is a link on our website homepage. We are also on many social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, etc. And we also have buttons to those platforms on the top of our homepage. Our website, www.biteradio.me, has much for you to explore and enjoy. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show.
Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us again. Today, my very special guest is Dr. Don McManus, Dr. Mac, and we're talking about the strong-willed child. Again, you can find out more about Dr. Mac and his work by visiting his website, which is strong-willedchild.com. Strong-willedchild.com. And again, I do have a direct link to his website in the show page description. And definitely go check out his website. He's got information with a free webinar, information about his books, articles, and the kids' songs that he mentioned earlier in the show. So with that, we're back. Dr. Mac?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, consequences for kids. Well,
yeah.
Probably the most important thing to understand is that when kids are strong-willed and or having defiance and behavior problems, then there's a whole host of things that need to be accomplished in the family, and only one of them is consequences. So probably one of the I would caution anyone, any listener, from just saying, oh, well, here's the thing to do, let's just do that, because essential ingredients. One is to have a 5-to-1 ratio. In other words, a very, very loving, close, connected relationship with your child, and to use praise in very deliberate ways. Catch kids being good, that kind of thing. Another one, as I said before, is the context of the parents' relationship with each other is important. Also, the sibling relationship is important. You know, how you introduce new ideas to kids is important, too, because you can't just sort of change the rules any more than if I was driving on the freeway and all of a sudden the speed limit changes and I haven't been sufficiently notified, you know. Hey, wait a minute.
Right.
It used to be 65, and you just gave me a ticket for going 45. Give me a break here.
Right. Okay.
So anyway, with that being said, what I do is you know, in this age range that's my specialty, which is sort of the 3 to 10 age range, the consequence that's typically used as an alternative to spanking is time out, and usually in the room, and usually, and unfortunately, because I think it's a total myth, you know, one minute per age of the child. So for a 9-year-old, if they do something, then they're in their room for 9 minutes. Well, it's all kind of, it's this procedure doesn't tend to work very well for most kids that I see, and there's tons of reasons for that. And one is that kids can get destructive in their room. Another one is that they won't even go to their room because the parents don't have enough power and influence, and then it's like, you know, struggles locking the door and stuff like that, or a kid being destructive in the room and crawling out the window. I mean, I've seen it all. So I advocate for a form of timeout that helps kids with what we call emotional self-regulation, which is, these are kids where when they have feelings, when they have big feelings, there's a loss of control. And what we know about the brain is there's this thing called an amygdala, and it's the flight and fight center, it's the fear center. And so, you know, kids who have trouble at being able to regulate their emotions so that they're acting appropriately, this particular procedure helps really well to have them stand in a timeout, but do so for only 30 seconds to a minute. There's no shame, no blaming, there's no whatever, and it's not like, you know, they're in front of the class and being laughed at. You know, would never time out a kid in a social setting, but when they're at home, this kind of timeout is very effective at helping them to learn how to slow deep breathe so they can get out of that darn corner or whatever. And
right.
So another consequences, you know, for older kids, for older than 10, 12, 13, but it's like the obvious solution and most helpful solution is to use a very short consequence, like taking a cell phone away or taking a video game away for a half an hour. And what we know then, like I said before, consequences are like medicine, so you don't want to use too much, you don't want to use too little. You start with small amounts of whatever's needed, and then you go on from there. So, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so I like that idea of, you know, small and then work your way up in case, you know, it doesn't work. So with the idea of, you know, not going overboard with the discipline, you know, quite often kids are subject to parents' expectations, you know, and sometimes, you know, it's hard for kids to meet the parents' expectations. So how does that area of expectation how does that?
Well, that's one of those things. Like I said before, it's all about balance and moderation. That you can be too strict and you've got a kid with a behavior problem, and then you can be too permissive and you've got a behavior problem. And when parents are too strict, they have too high expectations for a child, then they can obviously be acting out of their anger. You know, it's like, this isn't fair, I don't like this. And usually strictness comes with kind of a punitive attitude. But I'll mention, I had a kid the other day, and this is a pretty frequent thing, Robert, in almost every first session I ask parents if they're waking their child up in the morning. And you say, well, why is that? Well, kids in the 2 to 12 age range, they can't sleep in. You know, the average teenager, they can sleep till 1 in the afternoon if they've stayed up late a couple of nights in the weekdays texting their friends or finishing a term paper or whatever. Teens can sleep in. Adults can sleep in. Kids in this 2 to 12 age range prior to puberty cannot make up sleep debt. So biochemically, they're really challenged. They cannot function because they don't have enough replenishment of their serotonin and dopamine and all those good neurotransmitters that allow them to have control over their emotions. So there is another physical component, physiological component to what it is that can make parenting so hard. And it's one thing that I insist on parents learning. And unfortunately, even though pediatricians know this, they're not screening sufficiently teaching parents about the importance of sleep with kids, and it's epidemic. So there's also a correlation with parents who are permissive, they let their kids stay up too late. And sometimes it's really understandable because, you know, I've been working all day and my child misses me and I can't get home before 6, and then we have to dinner and homework and I really want to hang out with them and give them the love they deserve. You know, if it's done at the expense of sleep, it's misguided, because when kids are woken up in the morning, they're sleep deprived and they can be basket cases and they can be melting down in school very easily and or at home too. So that's one of those new pieces of research that I want to just shout from the mountaintops. It can make such a difference. You know, your child is sleep deprived. It's like, you know, like if I was depressed and I went on a medication, sleep can give you the same thing that you get from an antidepressant or an anti-anxiety drug. Sleep and exercise and nutrition are really important factors. And it's also, I would say it's essential to understand that when kids are acting out, there almost is never just one cause for it. It's a whole bunch of things. It's like 5 or 6 factors, and you want to hit them all. To create the change in the quickest fashion possible.
Yeah. So when people come to you with, seeking your assistance, I understand you do a family assessment. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it stems from our first book. My wife and I, after about 40 years of practice, said, "Hey, we know a few things here, but let's find out some more." And so. She primarily, because she's like the super academician, pouring through the research, what are the keys to a healthy, happy family? And we pulled out 10 keys. I mean, it's pretty clear what's important. Rather than an emphasis on here's a child and they have this problem, the focus of attention is on what can the family do how can the family be better so that all family members are bringing out the best in each other? And so there's things like how they handle feelings and communication, healthy boundaries and decision-making and positive attitudes and accepting differences and parents being on the same page. And I'm just naming a few of the many. So we have this little, we have a book that we wrote called How's Your Family Really Doing? 10 Keys to a Happy, Loving Family. And there's a, at that website, howsyourfamily.com, there is a free test for people to take, and they can assess their own family, and they can figure out, hey, here's where we're really great, and here's where we probably want to put some attention because it's not so great on the hierarchy thing. And that's actually one of the keys, is that parents are in charge, you know, in healthy families. They respect their children. Their children also respect them, kind of goes both ways. So that helps families to figure stuff out. It's almost like a blood test. You know, if you went to a doc and you say, you know, how am I doing? Oh, I need to take your blood. Oh, whoa, your cholesterol is a little high here, and here's what we should do about it. You know, so it's that kind of attitude with it. It helps folks to self-diagnose in a almost a playful, friendly way. And actually, teenagers like taking the test too. So that's a part of what we do.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's really great because that's such a holistic approach, you know, to family dynamics, you know, and it really kind of reinforces what family is all about, you know, and in today's environment, you know, sometimes we lose sight of what that structure, the whole, you know, family structure. You know, kind of
right. The
can do for
family
us.
Families are very, very stressed out, and there's no surprise that kids are struggling more, and you know, you see more epidemic proportions of even younger kids. Oh my gosh, years ago, Robert, I'm telling you, like in the last 6 years, I've had my child hates me. You know, they told me they hate me and they want a different mother and they're going to, or that they're going to hurt themselves or even kill themselves. Like, I never heard that in my first 25 years of practice. And now I get these phone calls all the time because, and part of it is the culture. I'm not blaming it all on, you know, the fact that two parents are working or they don't have time or whatever.
Right.
But families are under a lot of stress. And so it's the current indicator of, or red flag that kids are raising when they say stuff like that. And one of the things I say to them on the phone right away is, you know, it's your child's best way of saying, I'm really upset right now. Don't necessarily take the word seriously. And we want to look into this more, but don't be calling 911 because you said kid's going to, you know, says he's going to kill himself. Because boy, if that happened, they'd be ringing off the hook.
I'm sure. Boy.
Yeah.
So now, guys, we're kind of getting down here toward the end. So there were, you know, two areas that I kind of wanted to touch on before we finish. And one of them was, you mentioned earlier, the idea or the thing about mirror neurons and the latest.
Oh,
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, there's an interesting story about it that, you know, in Parma, Italy in 1995, they discovered these mirror neurons in monkeys because the monkey would... They had motor movement from the computer analysis of the monkey's brain. When the experimenter raised his arm to eat an ice cream cone, the monkey's brain lit up as if the monkey was eating that ice cream cone kind of thing. So then it took another 10 years at UCLA, and they figured, oh, my, we figured out mirror neurons out of the 80 billion neurons we have in our brain. Millions are mirror neurons, and so even if you're in an fMRI machine, your brain's getting scanned. If you are looking at a picture of someone doing something, your brain lights up almost as if you're doing that same thing, right? Then they discovered the connection between these mirror neurons and the amygdala that I talked about before. The amygdala is the size and shape of an almond. It's in the center of the brain. It's the center of what we call the emotional brain. And that amygdala is the fight or flight or the fear center. And so what we now know conclusively is that the brain is a social organ. It's constantly feeding and fueling information from other people's brains that are in close proximity to you. It's remarkable. And so their conclusion, this is neuroscientists, not family therapists, saying emotions are contagious. And you could relate to that. You know, you say, you know, well, I went out to lunch with a friend and she was really depressed, and then I got depressed and I was checking my watch by 12:30 and wanted to get out of there. Or you can have the experience of seeing somebody who's anxious on stage and everybody's heart starts to pound when they're in the audience, you know. So emotions are contagious. So what are the implications for parents? Well, you got to take care of your own stress. And you want to have constructive ways of not just managing or trying to subdue your own emotionality, your heightened emotionality, your upset with your child. You want to be in a centered place in order to not trigger their emotional brain, because if you're not, their brain is going to just cycle back to you what's going on for you. So that's the most important thing. So that's a big part of what I guide people to do, is not just here's what to do, like a cookbook, here, you know, crack two eggs and add the flour. It's
right.
Largely about how do I help you as a parent prepare yourself for meeting out consequences or dealing with your child in a way that's more centered and loving and more matter of fact. Metaphor, if I'm speeding on 101, which is the local freeway here, if a policeman stops me, it's not, you know, they don't yell at me, they don't lecture me, they don't throw me in jail or hit me or whatever. They just give me a ticket. So that's kind of a good metaphor, a model for how parenting works best, is for parents to get a hold of their own emotions, express their own emotions in a constructive way apart from their child through exercise or through a number of procedures that I described, and then go interact with your child and do it in this more centered, caring way. And then you're not going to see the same kind of reactions emotionally on their part, because you've handled your own thing.
Yeah, exactly. And that kind of leads me to my last question about, are there certain parents who would find it easier or maybe more difficult to implement your approach?
Or even just a parent in general, for sure. So one would be parents who have been insufficiently given positives when they're growing up, you know, because we know that love and warmth is part of parenting. So, you know, so parents who just didn't get, it's hard to give as a parent what you didn't get, you know. Their little emotional bank account had never got filled up sufficiently. So that's a key factor. The obvious ones are parents who also had any forms of abuse or maltreatment, where the feelings that they have are stored up. In other words, I could be mad at my dad for years because he's, an alcoholic and treating me abusively and or whatever, and those feelings store up. And another research finding about, from the brain research, is that in the amygdala, in that emotional brain, things that happened 30 years ago are just as if they happened yesterday. And things that are symbolically associated with something, with a person or an interaction, will get re-triggered very easily. So some parents, instead of just implementing a program, they've got to do a little bit of work, or at least have some insight on the fact that their parenting is so influenced by their childhood and how they were treated, and what's inside of them that really needed to come out years ago, like, don't treat me like that, or whatever, it's just kind of like, there's feelings inside that haven't been resolved and haven't been felt and expressed, and it doesn't mean you have to call up your ailing mother and scream at her over the phone and to resolve things. It's something that you can do therapeutically, and there's really excellent methods now for helping people to heal through their childhood so that they don't have to be the victims of their past or have it bleed into their parenting as it might.
That makes sense. Okay. Well, this has really been a wonderful chat, Dr. Mack. I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Now, I also had a note that because I'm going to reference, later on I'll be referring, kind of promoting the show, but howsyourfamily.com has the survey, right, for people to take.
That's
and
correct.
Kind of get engaged. And then I also noticed on your website that your songs are on happykidssongs.com, correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
And I was going through, and you got some really great articles and reference on your website. So that's a
right.
Really,
and I want to give my wife credit too, because she's been very involved in a lot of these creations. So she's and in fact the blogs are mostly written by her. So she's great.
Oh, okay.
Too,
well,
so.
Tyler, good job.
Thank you.
I look at a lot of websites, and yours is very easy to navigate, and it's very clear and simple. And again, like I look at a lot, so you know,
okay.
Yours is one of the better ones. So definitely give her my kudos
as well.
Thank you,
Robert. And thank you so much for the inspiring work that you do, being a voice to the world, so that people can learn good new things and spread good information around.
Great. Thank you, Dr.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Have a good day. Again, everyone, today my very special guest has been Dr. Don McManus. We've been talking about the strong-willed child. Again, you can find out more by visiting his website, which is strong-willedchild.com. Again, there is a direct link to that website in the show page description. And also definitely check out howsyourfamily.com and also happykidssongs.com. So everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's biteradio.me. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Byte Radio Me, and our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.